Mental health and wellness are crucial aspects of well-being. Their understanding and acceptance are vital for the progress of society. In a cultural context, mental health is often shrouded in stigma and misunderstanding, leading to a lack of proper support and care for those affected. Heal Your Mind with Tracy Kotzen is a platform for candid conversations that enlighten and enrich our understanding of mental health and wellness. Join us as we demystify, destigmatize, prioritize, and shine a light on mental health and healing. Heal Your Mind podcast with Tracy Kotzen is hosted by Mental Wellness Initiative and supported by the Ford Foundation.
Good day and welcome to Heal Your Mind with me, Tracy Kotzen. Today, I'm joined in studio by three guests and one guest online as we discuss Beyond the Bruises, how trauma impacts intimate relationships. In studio, I have Zoe Pardee, author of God's Loving Ways for Me. Zoe is a minister, life coach, and motivational speaker. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you so much.
We have Martin Palders, the CEO of Matrix Men and author of The Pumpkin Van. Nice to see you again, Martin.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
We have Kavya Swaminathan from Tears Foundation, and she's an interventions manager. Hi, Kavya.
Hi.
Etienne Lowe, online, author of The Silent Scream. Hi, Etienne, and welcome.
Hi, thank you.
It's good to have you all with us today. We often talk about trauma, and each of you is, in some respect, very well versed with the topic of trauma. So let's start with yourself, Martin. What is your expertise in the space of trauma? Tell us a little bit about yourself and your work.
Yeah, wow. Expertise. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I was a victim of sexual abuse and emotional, physical abuse from the age of 5 to the age of 19. So I had various perpetrators in my life, starting with Mummy Dearest, lovely lass, with her own issues, moving on to, again, an older woman who raped me when I was 12, a couple of guys that molested me in between, and then when I was from about the age of 13 to 19, I had one particular guy who controlled my life. And I have to emphasize that it was definitely very controlling. Mm. And for me, there was sort of no escape, you know. So yeah, you deal with this and the way that it impacts on your life, and 5 suicide attempts later, and addiction and all that sort of stuff. And we're still here. So I decided I survived and that I needed to be a voice for men who've suffered the same sort of thing, because after all, at the end of the day, it was hearing somebody else's story that allowed me to start the healing journey. Mm. And I kind of made a decision sort of 6 months into my healing journey that I was going to tell my story as often as possible to help other men, give them permission to start their healing journeys. Mm. So it's been an interesting 13 years. Yeah, very. Mm. So, yeah, and in the interim, we've helped 100 plus men. You know, it's not like they're queuing up to run in the doors and get help, you know.
Right.
Still one of those issues that men don't want to talk about. Yeah. Mm. But, yeah, that's essentially what I do.
Mm, Martin, thank you.
Thanks.
Kavya, you work in a professional space where you're exposed to quite a lot of trauma, clients coming in with different types of trauma. In a nutshell, what is your take on the trauma that's out there in the world and what people are going through?
People are going through so much, and I think when people think trauma, everyone thinks big, right? Mm. They want the physical abuse, the sexual violence, and all of those stuff, but trauma is big for you as a person. No matter how big or small anyone else sees it, it's big for you. Mm. And I think the thing that you see that is so universal in all of the clients and all of the stories and all of the people I've been able to interact with is that it stays with you and it comes out when you realize it's coming out, when you don't. And I think that's the scariest part, when you don't even realize why you do the things you do, when you can't trace it back. And I think it's just the healing that people go through and the change and the metamorphosis and the person that they find at the end of the road when they actually are ready to embrace that healing journey. Mm. And I think that's the other thing, right? We talk about healing and this journey. It is a journey. You have good days. You have bad days. You have to be ready for it. And I think that's the scary part, right? healing doesn't really work unless you're really open to the process. So it's just that the multitudes that you get from everyone that I've got to interact with and speak with. So, yeah.
And a brief point to touch on to additional to what you've said is you're being exposed to other people's traumatic stories. Does it affect you?
Yes, it does. And I think my heart breaks for every person that I speak to. And a lot of the times people will say, oh, it must be so hectic listening to all these stories and just taking all of that in. I think from what affects me the most is that I work in a space where there are so many intersecting departments, right? Mm. So we deal with police, we deal with hospitals, we deal with nurses, with families and all of those things. And what really gets to me and I think really breaks my heart the most is that when someone has done everything, they've gone through all the right processes, they've reported it to who they need to, they've given their statements, they've done everything, and then a system is just failing them on every level.
Mm-hmm.
When resources are failing, where people who are supposed to help you don't have answers, I think that breaks my heart more than anything else, really. Mm.
I hear you. It's brave work. It's brave work to stand with people who are going through quite a lot. Etienne. Hi, Etienne.
Yes.
Hi. Etienne, tell us briefly a little bit about yourself, your journey, and why this topic is so important to you.
Well, when I was 18 years old doing my military service, I was in a serious car accident where I fractured my neck. I spent a couple of months in hospital, and then was transferred to the Army sickbay with a neck brace on. The medic on duty, we were alone in a sickbay that night, there were no other patients. Gave me some meds. I woke up when he was sexually assaulting me. From that moment on, I started drinking copious amounts of alcohol. I started smoking for the first time. I confided into the sister and the doctor the following morning, and both of them said that the person in question, sorry, his name is also Martin, would never do such a thing. The doctor, however, stitched up my wounds and told me never to mention it again because this happens in the Army on a daily basis and boys will be boys. So for 40 years, I put it in a box and tried to forget about it. I got married when I was at, after I finished varsity. I had serious anger issues, substance abuse issues, alcohol, alcohol problems. And that led to the eventual divorce 30 years later. To me, I kept quiet for 40 years, and then 2 years before COVID, I lost my mother, my brother, and my father. And during COVID, my best friend, where I had to do CPR on him, and I couldn't revive him, and I emotionally fell apart. That's when I found a therapist for the first time that I could relate to. And it took 2.5 years of psychotherapy. And all these things came flooding back and started making sense to me why I was where I was or acted the way I did. And it was through that counseling and starting to journal and to write that I started healing, understanding myself, finding peace in myself, forgiveness of the person, my perpetrator. Besides that first attack, there was a second incident where I was gang raped by 5 people, also in the Army. And all of that, affected me to such an extent that keeping quiet for 40 years was probably the worst thing I could have done. And like somebody else has said, and I think Martin mentioned that, is talking as much as possible about it, the more you heal. And I found that is the case since I started opening up, since I started writing, since I spoke to about 1,000 people in the Navy and the Air Force in Cape Town about a month ago about this, where the response were phenomenal. But unfortunately, the outcome of that was where they also felt that they were banging their heads against a brick wall, that they couldn't talk about it because their careers would be affected. But that, yeah, that's my story.
Etienne, thank you for sharing your story, and I am very sorry for what happened to yourself and to you, Martin. Let me not. It's too early to cry. It's too early to. It's just too early in the day for. But it is seriously devastating. I think even 40 years later, one cannot underestimate the impact it has on a person. It's then your burden for life. So I'm back to Zoe. Zoe, tell me a little bit more about you, your work, and why this topic is important to you.
Oh, my good kid. Thank you so much for that. Zoe, it's a long story, but I'll try and make it short. I am a minister. I am a life coach. I also do motivational speaking and many more things that if I were to say, it will be like a Bible. But other than that, for me, I just want to say I was hated by my parents. That's how I felt. I felt as if they hated me. If I share just a little experience with that, I remember my father would come from work on Fridays and called me, and then he will ask me, "Where's my older brother?" But all of us, I'm actually the only one girl out of 7 boys. Mm. But I was supposedly the last born. Yeah. So what would happen, I'll have to know with my elder brother, otherwise he will hit me, beat me. Like, I still have in my head, if I were to say that, I think I was around 10, 11, 12, if I were to say that. And whenever he would speak to me, he would say, "You know what? I am going to beat you, and you are going to go and look for your mother, and then she will tell you who your father is." Mm. You see, this was much more deeper now. Mm. Okay, it didn't make sense at that time. And at that time, still, I didn't know who my mother was at the time. Then at 13, he decided to say, "Pack your things. I don't ever want to see you in my life." My supposedly father, if I were to say it like that. Mm. I packed, I left. So that's when I started to stay in the streets now, but I would be kept by friends, go and sleep with this friend. 13. So what happened now, having to stay in different people and experience all these things, having to move around a lot. No one was looking for me in my family, not even my brothers. And then I remember now my teacher at school, oh my God, it was a planned rape, if I were to say it like that, because one of my teacher, he came to a place where I was at, in one of my friends, as I was moving around in different people, places and different people to stay with, having to find myself. And he comes, and the reason that I'm saying it was planned, this rape, it was my friends were four. They knew about this, because when he came, he says, "Hi, ladies, can I please buy you some drinks?" And for some reason, all of them said, yeah, it's fine. And then he searched his pocket, only to find that his wallet is not there. And he says, "Can any one of you accompany me?" And they all of them say, "Zoe, you can go with him." And this is the teacher that used to beat me in class, because I was unable to if he's asking me a question, I couldn't answer. For instance, and then he'll always give me those. For some reason, I couldn't tell what caused him to do that. Then we went to his place, going to fetch his wallet. And then I stood by his door, and then he went to his bedroom, he'll go and take his wallet, and then a few minutes say, "Zoe, come here." I say, no, say, "I'm fine here." And by then I did not think that he would do anything. No, he's like, "No, come in my room. If both of us were able to look for this wallet, we'll find it so that I can buy you guys drinks." This was an older person, very much older. And then from there, and then I went to his room and I find him naked. And I was like, "Sir, why aren't you wearing your clothes?" He said, and then he pushed the door behind me. He's naked. And this is an old man. I'm only 16 now. From 13 having to move around and all, I'm 16 in this age. So he pushed me. Yeah, I embraced this moment at times on top of his bed, being naked. And then he was strong, remember, and then he forcefully took out my clothes and did what he wanted to do and force himself. And from there, I never told anyone. I think of only few people that know about this in my life. I've never really spoke about it as I'm saying it. I'm talking about it right now. But to think about it, because of my father, I always believe that I deserve pain. If my father hated me, so that guy has a right to do that to me. So I didn't report it to nobody. And having to do that, in the long run, now I meet my mother at 18. This is the first time I meet this woman. And also, we don't get along. And I'm trying to for this woman to love me. I want this mommy feeling, but she's just not there. And my father he said, "Mom, go and look for your mother. She will tell you who your father is." Now, this woman, I'm struggling to call her mommy. She's married in another side. Yeah, she's got her own family. My father had all her own family. I'm caught in between. She's got two boys. He's got two boys also on his side of the marriage. Here I am having to struggle to communicate with my mother. We don't know each other. I'm this teenage girl. And then we really struggle, if I were to say that, because I remember him, her also. For some reason, I was lucky to be beaten by my parents. if I were to embrace it like that, lucky, because these are the people that were supposed to love me, according to me. Then we could not even get along. I would be beaten by or being slapped by small man. Why didn't you wash the dishes? Why didn't you take care of the kids and whatever? Yes. And whenever she will shout at me and said, "You are useless. You will never be anything in life." I love those words now, because now I grew up wanting to prove myself. I will be something. I will be something. Having to do so now, that made me to actually suffer in relationship, because I met a broken man too. Oh my word, doesn't this end?
I think we're going to get to your broken man. Because I think that takes us quite naturally into the next part of the conversation. So from different perspectives, we've all come to the context with trauma. The reason I do this work and this podcast in particular is because I too am a survivor of all sorts of abuses, sexual abuse, physical abuse, all sorts of things. And like you, Zoe, I could fill volumes with the story. But I think what's important is that everyone can fill volumes with their story. And whilst we get to sit around the table and have conversations openly, 99.9% of the world are sitting with this stuff just locked up inside, locked up in their hearts. And I get the sense that most people have this inner narrative that says, "I don't want to talk about it. I just want to be quote unquote normal. If I ignore it, it will go away." It's been 35 years, so why the hell am I not over it already, you know? And I think it's within that narrative that the trapping begins, because the trauma is still running your show, whether you're talking about it or not. And now we carry that nice fat suitcase into a relationship. So Etienne, maybe from your point of view, and just thinking about the impact on you said you were married for 30 something years. before things came apart. Yeah. Sorry?
Mm. 30 years exactly, almost to the month before we got divorced.
So what?
In my first year of varsity, or actually the first week, I met this girl. And there was an immediate attraction. And we started going out. And when I saw that things were moving in a direction where it could be serious, she was the first person besides the two people in the army that I felt that I needed to mention to her that this has happened to me. And I did it in one sentence only, and I just told her that I was sexually abused in the army. Clearly, it was a shock to her, but she was very supportive, empathetic, and... that was the first time that I felt that somebody actually heard me and didn't judge me or didn't push me away. And we were together for 4 years before we got married. But by that time, like I say, I was really struggling during my varsity years. I was drinking. Drinking when I got up in the morning before I went to lectures, just to numb the pain. I was drinking to fall asleep and to try not to have nightmares and to wake up during the night. We got married, and we 4 years later we had a daughter. And for some reason, soon after the birth of the daughter, our intimate life started, because my wife really wanted a big family. She's Portuguese, or was Portuguese, and she wanted a big family. So after the birth of the first daughter, I contracted testicular cancer, so I couldn't have more children. And our intimate life just started falling apart. But one of the things that also, because of what happened to me, is that I never felt comfortable with intimacy. That sexual experience, that first attack on me, was my first sexual experience, and to me it was always something dirty, ugly, something I resented, and I found it difficult to relate to that. I was angry. I was a very protective father because I didn't want anything to happen to my daughter in the same sense that it happened to me. But like I said, the slightest thing could trigger me. I had a very low self-confidence. I was becoming antisocial. I was doubtful and suspicious of people. I couldn't be in groups where men were involved. It was just depression, and I had to fight every day to try and lead a normal life. It was difficult to discuss these things with my wife without bringing up the past, which I didn't want to discuss. And somehow we managed it through the 30 years. But when my daughter, she studied medicine, and when she finished, she immigrated to the UK, where she's practicing now. And that's when we decided to call it a day, that we felt that we would be happier apart, living our lives separately, than having this constant battle and not really understanding each other, because at that point I was still not talking about it. I was still not opening up. I was still not truthful with her. I was not even truthful with myself. I forgot a lot of the stuff. I just ignored it.
Etienne, thank you. There's so much resonance between your story and Martin's story, in fact. Martin, you were married as well. And there's similarities.
21 years of
The effect it had on your relationship.
Anger and hatred. Yeah, it was. Yeah, I think you know, I looking back on it now, I kind of, my worst phase of life was between 18 and 24, 25. That's where I struggled with sexual identity. I started, you know, thinking that I couldn't find happiness anywhere. And I really thought of myself as an ugly human being. I detested myself. I've had body dysmorphia most of my life, and I could have been as thin as a rake, but I still thought I was fat. And so there was so much happening in my head that one day, I mean, a long-term kind of relationship broke up when I was about 21, and, you know, she started dating my best friend who, you know, so, you know, there's dramas that happen in friendship circles and things like that. And I was just so deeply hurt by it because I didn't have the confidence to be able to go out and speak to people, or women especially. But I was the party animal, right? I was the man who was the joker, and he was the guy to have around at the parties all the time. And so alcohol kind of works wonders in that sense. But so eventually I met this very young lady, and my introduction to her was, I'm looking for a nymphomaniac that's going to spend a week with me on Lake Kariba. Are you keen?
Was that your opening line?
That was my opening line. You know? And she said, yes. That should have been like a warning sign for me there, right? Turns out, I mean, she was 16. She was 8 years younger than me. I was 20. No, she's 17, just turning 18. Anyway, I was 24. I mean, I've just come out of all sorts of relationships, gay relationships, you know, whatever. And I can see how enticing the gay lifestyle is, because it's just like you wink at somebody and say, hey, what's up? And boy, sex is on the table, you know. But I got to a point, thankfully, where I realized that I wasn't homosexual. So that confusion was out the way. But I still didn't have the confidence. And when I looked at this young girl, I was like, no, I mean, you know, it's cool. I'll settle. And I still remember thinking, I'll settle, you know. It's okay, because we're intimate, and she's giving me what I want as a man. It's, you know, I always say to young girls, there's one thing between the ages of 16 and 30 that men want. And, you know, so if you want a real relationship, don't give that one thing. And if he really loves you, he'll stick around, you know. But anyway, we were intimate, and then I broke up with her. Yeah, after an evening in bed, I was like, you know, this isn't working out for me.
after one evening.
Well, much later. I mean, it was a couple of years later. But, you know, like, we were intimate, and then I like, well, yeah, you know, this is not really working out for me. And she was like, what? After sex? Now you tell me you're dumping me. I was like, hey, I needed a last one, you know. Yeah. Anyway, so that was the relationship. And then we broke up. And about 3 months later, she started phoning me again, and I felt sorry for her. And then 2 years later, we got married, and it was like, I felt like I'd wronged her, and I owed her. So we got married, and I didn't know she was broken. She didn't know I was broken, and so the hate began.
The dance of destruction, because the broken in me and the broken in you are a match made in heaven.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, everybody goes opposites attract. I'm going like, well, that's utter nonsense, right? You're always attracted to the same kind of broken that you are, because that's your normal, that's your level of normal. So when you're in a dysfunctional family, you're attracted to somebody who also comes from a dysfunctional family, because that's what you're used to.
Yeah.
You know, I've remarried like 6 years ago now, and my daughter met my wife, and she was like, Dad, these people are crazy. I'm going like, why? What do you mean? They're crazy. You know, she says, they all love each other. They all support each other. It's not normal. I'm going like, no, baby, that is the normal. It's our family that's the mess, you know. And as the head of that family, it's like essentially I led that family into destruction. I mean, my daughter walked around in eggshells every day. She never knew if daddy was coming home, never knew if daddy was coming home in a good mood, in a bad mood. You know, and that's the sort of pain you don't want to inflict on a child of, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's just ridiculous. It's very painful.
Just on the destruction of the family with the anger issues and the disruption My daughter is now in the UK, and we haven't spoken. She's broken all ties with me. We haven't spoken to each other for 4 years. And it is because she's seen me as this angry, destructive person.
Can I give you a word of encouragement, Etienne? It's not over, right? It's not irreparable, you know. You know, after the divorce, I was alienated from my daughter, and she came into my life again when she was 18. And the instruction she was given is like, if you want to have a relationship with your dad, you're going to have to sue him for money. That's from mommy. And when she finally did come back into my life, she was told that I was this angry person, that I wanted to rape her.
Oh,
I'm like, yo. So imagine your child comes back into your life. She barely knows you now. And she has all this fear and angst, you know. It's like, I need to protect myself from my father, but I don't have anywhere else to stay, so I'm reliant on him. But seriously, over the last 6 years, we've built a great relationship, in fact. And it started with me just being brutally honest with her, going like, you know what, I cocked up, and I'm sorry. I was. This is my story.
Yeah.
This is what happened to me. It's not an excuse, but it's that's what happened, and that's life. And I would really like to mend the relationship and get to know you. I've changed my ways, you know, and we've now built up, and I got two beautiful grandchildren. We talk just about every day, and you know, so it's good. I mean, there's still issues in my head, and as I'm sure there are still issues in her head, but we have a great relationship.
And I want to add to what Martin's saying about it's not over till it's over.
Yeah.
My dad had a drinking problem when we were kids and a violence problem. And, you know, when I had a son, I decided I'm not going to expose my child to my father's behavior, which was still ongoing at the time. And I didn't speak to him for 5 years. I really feel bad about it when I think about it now. I even returned birthday gifts. If my father sent gifts to my son, I would return them because I literally didn't want him in my life. All I saw was destruction. All I saw was the alcohol. All I remembered was being the little girl who had to clean up the blood and the broken glass after a fight. And it was in my maturity as an adult woman raising this, what was once a baby is now a 20-year-old, 21-year-old with a whole beard and everything. I have a grown man walking around my house now.
It's scary.
It happened overnight as well. So it was my journeying with motherhood and recognizing how flawed I am as a mother, trying my best every day and cocking it up 5 ways before breakfast that allowed me to start having compassion for my parents. And I changed the nature of the questions I was asking. Instead of saying, oh, why did they do that to me? Why couldn't they love me the way I wanted to be loved? I started saying, who failed them? What happened to them? You know, why are they hurting? Because, and again, probably partly my professional training, but also just maturity. And being willing to recognize that if I'm doing my best and epically still messing up, when people had less resources, when we were less able to talk about the stuff that was wrong with us, you know, what did our parents and our grandparents go through that are inherited down the line? So, Etienne, I hope for you that when your daughter, if she does, get exposure to these conversations that you have, and as she matures, she will start to understand the place you were at that point in time and have a lot more compassion and arrive at a place of forgiveness. I'm there with my dad, complete and utter love and forgiveness and compassion, complete. There's no residual stuff between us. But it took work. It took work for me as the daughter also to choose the compassionate path. But I'm holding out hope for you, buddy.
Thanks. That's what the reason writing the book. The book was written for her. that she could let you know who her father was.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, and I'm sorry is a great introduction to a discussion. Mm. You know, because quite often as parents we come across, I know everything. Don't argue with me. Mm-hmm. Listen to your father, isn't it? Yeah. That's what we taught, right? And then suddenly you turn around and you go like, I'm sorry, I really messed up royally, you know. And that kind of makes them go, okay. You might not get an instant response, but it'll come.
It'll come.
Every girl wants to know her daddy.
How I wish.
The real daddy.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Zoe.
I want to go across to Kavya. From a... I mean, before we started recording, you were telling us, I'm going to bring your family into this now.
Yeah.
You were telling us, oh, my parents are so beautiful and gross. And I was very confused because I didn't know what that meant. And then you described this real love and affection and kindness that they have for each other. And I get why you say gross, because if my husband and I do displays of affection, my boys just go, oh, my God, and they roll their eyes and they walk away. It grosses them out. But it's such a contradiction to grow up in a space of healthy relating versus growing up in a space of dysfunctional, toxic relating. Mm-hmm. And I know you're supposedly here in your professional capacity from tears, but it wouldn't hurt to hear as a child growing up in would you describe it? Let me start there. Would you describe it as a healthy, loving space in the dynamic between your parents?
Yes. Like not to say they don't have problems. They fight. They have their own issues.
Sure.
But what has always been blueprinted for me was partnership. Relationships are partnerships. And I think they always blueprinted that romantic relationships, but any relationship that you have is a partnership. There is give and take. There, sometimes someone gives more. Sometimes someone gives less. Sometimes you're not giving anything, but you kind of have to have enough open dialogue and enough space to kind of just explore that. And what was really mapped for me when I was younger is that my parents both handle their emotions and issues completely differently from each other. They process very differently, but somehow they made it work. They kind of did their own thing and then they'd come back and have a conversation. And I always appreciated that about them. Mm. And it's weird because my mom and I fight and my dad and I fight and we fight in very different ways. But at the end of the day, we figure it out. I think that was the one thing that they always blueprinted on me is that we will have our stuff and we will never agree on everything. My dad and I, for example, have incredibly different political views and we will fight every time we watch the news. It's just a thing. Mm. He will call me a crazy, like, bra-burning liberal and I will call him a bigot. Like, we'll do our thing. Mm-hmm. And then we will have a civilized conversation about the exact same thing, like, 10 seconds later.
Yeah.
When my dad and I have, and I use my dad because I think we are very similar in that way. We're very explosive people. We have long tethers, but once it is done, it is done. My mom is far more understanding. She had lots of siblings growing up and she was a middle child. So she is the mediator, the bringing everyone to the table and let's talk about our feelings. Yeah. And it's, for me, it's just been a balance of that. My dad will have an explosion. He'll be like, leave me alone. I'm going to the driving range. Mm. But then he will come back and be like, no, we can talk about it. Mm. Like, I've hit enough balls with the people I dislike's faces on them. It's fine. So that's how that's always been blueprinted to me. Yeah. And it was weird. I'm not going to lie, because we moved to South Africa from India. So we were just the three of us. I'm an only child. It's just me, mom and dad. And we moved to a different country when I was very young and we were still a very singular unit.
Mm.
So we're close, I think, by necessity, if nothing else. And I went to school here and not only was it different culture, it was different people. Yeah. And I ended up having friends who were very similar to me, as in we were all very anxious, high-strung, type A crazies, but they had such different families. And I just happened to have friends that came from very dysfunctional families. And my parents will be like, no, they can stay over, they can do this, they can do that. Mm. And I never got it. And I know that sounds so awful, like now with professional training stuff and far more empathy and understanding and all the technicalities of life. But growing up, I never spoke about my family growing up to my friends because I'm like, I can't exactly say how my dad, drove all over town to get flowers for my mother when you were telling me a story about how your mom stabbed you the other day. So it doesn't work the same way. Yeah. So I actually never grew up talking about my family or what was blueprinted of me and stuff like that because it's awkward.
So that's a really, really important point. So, and I've heard one or two similar things from conversations in the past where people who have got good, healthy, happy lives don't actually want to talk about that in the presence of someone else's trauma because mm-hmm. it feels like you're rubbing it in their faces.
Breaking you of some sort.
Right. Yeah.
And it's also about relatability, right?
Mm. Yeah.
And this is going to sound like an awful story and I'm very sorry, but my friends and I have a pretty dark sense of humor. And I had a friend who was far wealthier than regular middle class. And she was from like a prominent white family. And sometimes she would call me to like vent about life. And I'd have to be like, is this something I can relate to? Or is this just me being a good listener? I need to know where I stand in this situation. And I think I get this from my mom, but she's always very understanding, very open listening, like really like takes what you say in. So when and I do this now, even in my personal, but it's about giving people space, right? Mm. So when someone is being that vulnerable with you, I feel like I don't want to get in, like, I don't need to put my bit into it, if that makes sense. It's, for me, I see it as that I didn't talk about my family, I didn't talk about my life, because you're clearly going through more and you need something. You need support, right? I had all the support I needed back home. I could be failing tests, my life could be imploding, my friends could hate me, I'd be crying every day. But my dad would cut me fruit and bring it to my room and be like, this is for you. That's me. I had all the support I needed. Those people didn't. I had friends, strangers, just people, acquaintances who have just opened up about stuff. And that was always very strange to me. Like the idea of opening up to a stranger so easily. I've met people in Varsity, for example, like first day orientation. I'm like, this has been like an info dump.
Mm.
But I'm like, they're just seeking connection and support. And who am I to say no to that with my own boundaries in place, of course, but they need that more than I need to be like, hey. So yeah.
Well, you've made a career of being a good listener.
So. No, exactly.
Yeah. So that worked out really well. Zoe, in your practice, and you wear multiple hats between ministry and life coaching and motivational speaking, which is really all forms of helping profession.
So
across the spectrum of that, and with your own story in the backdrop, how do you think, if you could pick one example, the way trauma shows up for people, historical trauma, so stuff that happened before that relationship, and you're now bringing it into the relationship, what do you think is happening there?
What I can say out of that, because if I were to say, in Black community, I'm sorry to specify that, we are mostly broken, as much it happens in other communities. You know? We are very broken, and this is something that has come from afar. It's kind of a generational of some sort.
Mm.
So there must be somewhere definitely where it has to stop.
Mm.
There must be somebody who's able to take a stand and say, if it happened to my mother, if it happened to my great-great-great, it needs to stop. And to say that also, because my father went to the grave with that hatred towards me. As I said, it was hatred.
Mm.
And I still don't know what happened between them. And yet I didn't have a relationship with my mother. We tried to make peace, but it didn't work. So for me, having to be now in ministry, having to be a life coach, it has been easy to speak and share my experience, because others, they wouldn't understand. How can your parents hide too? How can you say, how is that possible? So the only thing that I took out of that for me was that, okay, maybe something happened there, there's something that they cannot tell me.
That's essentially because they hate themselves.
So having, when now I speak to people, because I learned, if, as I said, if we were to ask ourselves, why are we here? I love or not, she was sharing, especially in Black communities, we don't experience that there is normality of some great things. Anything that is great or beautiful in Black communities looks is evil. I'm sorry.
That's true. Yeah.
Hold on. Yeah. Unpack that.
Yeah.
Unpack
that. I want to know more about that. What you mean by that?
Oh, sorry about that. This is what I've seen. This is what I've observed in a way that in some Black, not all of them, if, for instance, you are married, you have a wife, you have kids, you are well off, a car and whatever, there's some bewitchment there.
Okay, so it's suspicious when it's normal.
Yes.
Yes. Suspicious when it's healthy. There's some bewitchment.
How can she have it all? I'm lawyer.
Okay.
There's moochie in it. So having to have those mindset in us, everything is witchcraft. So it's like a Black person, you cannot have a beautiful thing. There must be, you went somewhere, you did this and this and this and this. So now when we meet as we are now with being diverse, it's beautiful to actually know that we actually go through the same things and different, and to have that, okay, there's somebody that you can be happy. I can be happy too. So now we need to change that mindset in the Black community of saying, you know what, our background has been messy because it has become a generational curse that needs to be stopped. So we need to take a stand. So whenever I would share that with wherever I would be invited, it's a matter, take stand, take a power, man. I know it happened. Good, bad things, they happen to good people. It's not like you did something to somebody, but things, they happen. So we need to take charge.
Yeah.
I hear you. And that's great advice. And I think it takes us into the next little bit. So here's my analogy for when we arrive in our relationship with our Louis Vuittons. That's what we call it. We come with our Louis Vuittons. I'm not brand dropping. Louis Vuitton did not sponsor this show. It's a metaphor for the suitcase, for the baggage that we bring into relationships. I feel like we unzip that bag and whatever whipping tools are inside it, we now beat up our partner with. So we'll just... our hatred of whoever, our father issues, our mistrust issues, and we
mother issues.
And we essentially beat, metaphorically or physically, beat up the person in our space. And if it's not metaphorical or physical, and Etienne, for yourself, for Martin, for people who struggle with addiction, I've got my dad in mind at the same time. Was when you're in the substance, you're not in the family, right? No. So you can beat up the family by in your absence is what I'm saying. It becomes its own punishment. And so we take all of our whipping sticks out of our baggage and we beat the heck out of people who were not there when the thing happened, when it happened years before. It was not their fault. All they want to do is love us unconditionally and hopefully for the rest of our lives. Why are we stuck, apparently as a species, on not being able to process the contents of that bag? Why do we carry it into the next space? Is it, and I'm going to throw a couple of things. Is it courage to open up the bag and actually deal with the really ugly, scary stuff inside? Is it shame? Is it what? Why are we inflicting ourselves on someone else? What is that?
I think there's so much to it. I mean, that's, you know, for me, there was, and I think for all men, I mean, to stand up and speak about the fact that you were either sexually abused or raped or whatever the case may be, it's like a no-no, right? Because that just, you know, everybody goes, I mean, masculinity is a bad rap, you know, but at the very core of me, that is who I am. I'm a, you know, I'd like to envisage myself as a confident, caring, loving, supportive, masculine man. I mean, that's the myth we sold, right? Then comes along societal pressure, right? And you opened up by saying, don't talk about it, it'll go away. You know, all that sort of stuff. And that's the message we constantly told. You'd be like, oh, leave it, forget about it, it'll go away, it'll disappear. And then add into that the constructs of society that tells us, like, there's something wrong with you if you're a victim of rape or sexual abuse, especially as a man. And it's the same for women, I believe. I mean, I'm not a woman, so I can't speak on behalf of them. So there's so much to it. And you're just forced into this little box where you just say, okay, I can't talk about this. It's also, I always maintain the fact that every child who's been raped or sexually abused by somebody will try and reach out to an adult at some point in time, right? And if they're silent for the next 30 years, that means that adult was like, fobbed them off, right? So I'm going and I'm trying to talk to people about what's happening to me. Nobody wants to listen. I think I tried to talk to my dad and he was like, well, you know, at that point in his life, it was in my sort of mid-teens, so 16, he thought I was gay. And that in those days was like a big shame. You know, it was like I failed as a father because my son is gay, whatever. And I tried to reach out to him and he was like, well, you know, that's what life is about. And like, I just shut down. That was it. I will never talk about this again. And, you know, so I can see in my life there's these points. So my first suicide attempt at 16, walking into a rape crisis center that told me as a boy I couldn't be a victim because of all the posters on the wall, all depicting women as victims, men as a perpetrator. Talking to dad, not being able to get through, you know. So there was all these kind of major points where I was just like, okay, alcohol's the answer. That's you know, that's the solution, because the more I drink, the more I don't have to think about this. And it's just easy. So it's a deep question. There's a lot to it, but I think it starts with that shame and societal pressure.
And to interject, you know, and to add on that, the triggers. The triggers that one would come across immediately once you are in a relationship, because the first few months you are together, everything is lovey-dovey. So remember now, you are guarding your heart. You have protected you have protected your heart. No one, I would not allow anybody else do this to me or say this to me. So you go to that person or to that relationship with that bag that is full of that. So immediately when the person does something else, like, then now the other person doesn't know how to respond to that, because to him or her now you are changing. You're not the person that you were when you first met. Then now it causes confusion. Confusion in the way that now maybe you don't know how, or he or she doesn't know how to communicate that to you, because now you are showing the other side of you that he or she has never seen it. You have triggered something. So how do we go about it? And now it's your fault. So all the baggage and everything that you had in your bag, throwing it to this person, and this person doesn't know how to react on this now. And especially if you are unable now to talk about things now, then it becomes wet. Silent treatment, all those things, you no longer talk to each and can't communicate. So it's
And also we've been talking about this from one direction, like you're bringing the baggage, but that person's got their own suitcase. So you've got whips and chains in yours and they've got knives and machetes in theirs, and we can just throw weapons of our past at each other.
And I think it's how you opened it, but when you asked, is it courage, is it stigma, is it this? And I think from what we've seen and everyone's experiences and what we're talking about, is it's all of those things, right? I think we open that bag and pull out those weapons, like you said, to protect ourselves. But for the same reason, we hide that bag, right? And that's what I think we were talking, I don't know if it was while we were recording or not, but we talk about the fact that it is that third person in the relationship. It's that third issue, right, that we don't talk about. It's like something that's constantly haunting you. And at the end of the day, trauma is hard, right?
Yes, it is.
And it's what exactly Zoe was saying. When you start a relationship, you're trying to put your best foot forward. And that's in romantic and just friendships and like platonic, all kinds of relationships. We're trying to put our best foot forward. And then it becomes a question of, at what point do I break the illusion that I have created about myself? Are they ready for that? And then you're putting pressure on that person, pressure that they don't know anything about. It's pressure on your relationship. It's just, there's so many things going on, right? And it is, it's taking that bit of bravery to unzip that suitcase. It's the societal pressure and the stigma and everyone else telling you that no, it's fine, it's fine, he doesn't need to know, that happened 20 years ago, it's fine, like you're over it, right? You're over it. I mean, and you're like, am I mean, I'm still carrying this around. I think it's also this idea that when we talk about luggage and this baggage or these issues or this our trauma is that we never actually leave it, right? We never leave the suitcase in like Grand Central Station and let it go where I'm sorry, I don't know train stations in South Africa, so I couldn't make that more relatable. But
they don't work anyway. So.
Like we can't actually leave it anywhere. Yeah. And one really pretty analogy that I learn about that I tell to clients, that I tell to myself honestly, is that our trauma never gets any bigger or smaller inside of ourselves, right? We as people choose to grow around our trauma. We get bigger so it feels smaller. But at the end of the day, your trauma is still your trauma. It happened to you. And good or bad, the things that we are or have experienced build who we are. Whether I'm able to trust people, whether I'm able to form relationships, whether I'm able to deal with my anger, step away from a situation, the good and the bad have molded us, right? And sometimes we have great partners who, like you said, will love you unconditionally, whose bag is just a little carry-on and not a massive suitcase. And they're there, and then they will actually teach you. They will help you, we hope, to build something else. I mean, I think in conversations like this, we do focus on the trauma, right? The scary, the bad stuff. But it's also important that that bag sometimes is filled with really good stuff. Like, when you were talking about my parents and stuff like that, I've seen relationships where they had that shitty experience growing up, right? They had the dysfunctionality. They had all that. And they were like, this is not what I'm going to do. They like overcorrected to like the supreme. Not always the perfect answer. Not in an ideal world. We'd hope for it. But I think at the end of the day, it's just complex and it sucks. At the end of the day, facing and opening that bag sucks. Whether there's good, whether there's bad, it just sucks. And it's hard. It's hard. And it's not as easy as just going to therapy or talking about my feelings or putting down the bottle. It's not that easy. It just sucks and it's hard sometimes. And sometimes you just got to do it. Sometimes you have to be able to put it aside for certain things and be like, I actually can't do this today.
Just to say this, I remember I developed, I don't know if there's a word like that, that says, love me, I'm nice syndrome. Love me, love me, I'm great. Why can't you see that? Love me, I'm here for you. And by then you're chasing them away. They don't understand. You look desperate. And for you, you are, it's not even intentionally, because you think this is love, because we need to go back and come back to ourselves.
And there's the other aspect we don't talk about, especially for ladies, is that they become promiscuous. And then there's that added shame that attaches to that, right? Because like, I'm a slut now because society's told me that.
I know a fair amount of pretty promiscuous guys too.
As well. I mean, I was that.
I think it's a human thing. What we want, we crave belonging and affection that we will trade what we can trade. And sometimes the only thing you have to trade is your sexual availability. So I wouldn't box it into one or the other, but I will give you this point that guys are more likely to get a high five for it, whereas girls are more likely to get shamed.
Absolutely.
Which is also a problem.
But it's just as as destructive for both.
For both.
That's what I'm saying. That's the thing. Everyone, whenever we talk about
Etienne,
the...
he's trying to say something.
Oh, sorry.
I'm trying to get... we're also almost out of time. So Etienne, while you've got the floor, wrap us up with also your wisdom for how people can address historical trauma earlier on in relationships so it doesn't cost them 30 years.
Okay. So just to catch up with what you guys were saying, I don't want to sexualize the whole thing, but as far as men is concerned, I think in most societies, men are supposed to be the strong ones. You don't feel, you don't cry, you have to be the leader, you have to be the head of the house, the breadwinner. And it makes it so much more difficult for a man to open up and to say, I'm weak, I have to cry, I've got emotions, I feel.
I just need a hug.
I think that is a big problem. And yeah, absolutely. As far as how to prevent things from getting too out of control or waiting too long. My problem was that I did seek help from psychologists, psychiatrists over the years in private without my family knowing. But I never felt that somebody was actually connecting with me to the point that one psychiatrist actually diagnosed me with anhedonia, which is the inability to feel happiness. And that stuck in my head, and I believed it. And for the rest of time, for decades, I believed that I'm not supposed to be happy. And the main thing is, you know, keep looking for that person who's going to listen to you, to hear you, to advise you, or to guide you to a center or to a professional that can help you. Yep. We can't help all these people, but we can guide them. Don't give up on the first, second, third, fourth person that fobs you off or tells you to forget about it or just snap out of it.
It's that same thing we teach our children, isn't it? Speak until somebody listens.
Yeah.
Right? And as survivors, adults, speak until somebody listens. And I gotta concur with you. Sorry, I'm taking over. But gee, I also went to like 5 or 6 professionals. I have to like caveat that professionals. I doubt they were, because the minute I actually found the courage to say, hey, you know, I was raped as a child, they like swallowed or moved in their seats. And that was a trust broken. Thank you very much. Bye bye. I'm out of here. Can't speak to you. And I mean, yeah, I feel you. I feel you.
Okay, whilst you've got the mic, words of wisdom. Let's assume there was a 22-year-old couple who are about to get hitched. How can you save them 25 years?
Don't.
we're going to edit that one out.
No, I would say, you know what? A friend of mine was going to start something called Everybody Needs 10. And I kind of go with her on this thing. She says every person she knows needs 10 therapy sessions. If you can't go into a therapy session and be honest with the therapist, then you're not going to be honest with your husband. I mean, you can't start off a relationship with lies. So it's take that bag off and say, this is my life. I mean, my second marriage, I had the privilege of doing that. I said to my wife, I said, this is who I am. You now have the choice to like leave me or stick with me. And she stuck with me, thankfully, you know. But, you know, don't go into a relationship thinking that you can start off with lies and deception, because it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. And also, if you're going to go into a relationship, don't do so broken. You know what? Get help. Go for those 10 sessions of therapy, because a healthy person will pick a healthy person, and together you can be a unified, supportive collective. You know, you become, you know, the two become one and all that sort of stuff, but you can't become one if you're broken. You're just going to shred each other. It's the opposite effect. You know? So get the help before you, you know, the sex is great, but it's not the solution. It's not the solution.
Yeah, so true.
So your parting words of wisdom.
For me, I'd like to say to each and every person out there that have gone through similar situation or more traumas and pains, I just want to say to you, I am so sorry. I am so sorry that you had to go through that and you waited for them to come to you and say, I'm sorry. And they didn't. So I just want to say to you, forgive them. Forgive yourself for allowing them to have that power over you, to put yourself or your life on hold because somebody has done something to you. Forgive them. I am so sorry that you had to go through that. So moving forward, I'll just say, claim your power, man. Life is beautiful. Life is beautiful. Claim your power. Whoever did a what to you, claim your power.
Yep.
Take charge.
Thank you, Zoe. Kavya?
The one thing I can say is that you cannot use someone else to fix yourself. So I think a lot of the times when we feel out of control or we have that baggage, we think this is a great person who gets me and they're the missing piece, right? In relationships, whether it's a partner, it's a friend, a parent, a family member, your goodness will be enough to fix me. And at the end of the day, it doesn't, no one else should matter because you need to be okay with you, whatever that is, whatever that looks like, whether it's partying every night, whether it's staying at home, whether it's sports, whatever it is, you can't use someone else to fix you. And healing is hard and it sucks. Everyone says that you'll go to therapy and it'll feel like a weight has been lifted off your shoulders. Yeah, but it takes you like a year to get there because you first have to like swim through the trenches and pick out the stuff that you didn't like and you didn't want to think about. And sometimes you'll realize that there are extra zippers in that suitcase of yours that has shit that you didn't even know that you left there from like five trips ago. And you're like, oh, damn. But it takes work and it takes time. And if you're ready to put in that work whenever you're ready, no one can force you to do it. You have to be it. At the end of the day, it's you. It's me, myself, and I. You have to be okay
no
first.
No one is responsible for you. Embrace your beautiful problems.
It was about 15 or 16 years ago when my husband and I had a pretty big, not physical, but verbal fight. And he turned around and said the most horrifying thing to me. He said, it's not my job to make you happy.
Ouch.
And I was like, what?
It isn't? Ouch.
Because are we not programmed that someone else is supposed to be the medicine to to your ailment, right? You're a half and they're a half and you're going to come together
fix it
and make a whole. And I think that is the biggest lie that we are sold.
So,
I want to encourage people to come in wholeness. And I'm so fixated on this phrase right now that you have a moral and ethical duty to do your healing work.
Definitely.
Yeah. Especially if you're going to be sharing life with another person or making some kids somewhere. You have that duty or you will be burdening that partner and that child with your trauma. And that's when intergenerational trauma becomes a problem. So it's no one else's job to make you happy. It's yours. Those are my words of wisdom.
I can fully agree with
that. You agree with that?
Absolutely.
Excellent.
100%.
Thank you, everyone. I think it's been a really great conversation.
Thank you.
And that is a wrap.
The producer's
Heal Your Mind. Absolutely. That is a wrap for Heal Your Mind with Tracy Gotson and my incredible guest today. Thank you so very much. Etienne Online. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for your courage, buddy. Amazing. Thanks.
Heal Your Mind podcast with Tracy Kotzen is hosted by Mental Wellness Initiative and supported by the Ford Foundation.